Good morning, and welcome back to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're pleased to have you listening this morning. In this hour, Focus, we will return to a topic that we have discussed before a number of times on the program, and that is the issue of global warming. We've done a couple of programs on the subject recently, and I think it's fair to say that probably most of the people that we have had on the program have taken the position that global warming was a phenomenon, it was real, that it was the result of human activity, and that we should be taking what steps we can to eliminate or cut down on the release of the so-called greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. It is also the case that not everyone in the scientific community supports that position. And we'll be talking this morning with someone who is one of the more prominent global warming skeptics. His name is Richard Lindzen. He's professor of meteorology at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And we thought that certainly as we had done a number of programs with people who were concerned about the issue of global warming, we should present some other views as well, and we're doing that here this morning. And, of course, questions also are welcome, questions and comments. We simply ask callers to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and accommodate as many people as would like to call in. Everyone is welcome to join the discussion. If you live in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Lindzen, hello.
Hello, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us today. I want to ask you, I think your name came to our attention, at least in part, because of an article from the New York Times from last year, I believe. And in it, there is from you a very strong quote. It is, "We don't have any evidence that this," meaning global warming, "is a serious problem." Is that still the way that you would feel?
Yeah, basically it is, yes.
Well, let me ask you, first of all, about the...
That's not a statement that it isn't. It's a statement about the evidence.
Well, I want to make sure that we are clear that the position you're taking is that it's that we don't know if it is or it's not. It's your position is that it's something that should be... that we should continue to study, to continue to gather data on, right?
Yes, of course.
What about the...
We should do so on the more general question of climate. That is to say, not just global warming, but how does the climate work?
Mm-hmm. You feel that we don't have nearly enough information about how the climate works generally?
Yeah, I think, for instance... we don't have any models that successfully produce the cycles of ice ages or explain the extremely warm climates of the past and so on. Under those circumstances, it's pretty hard to say we understand climate.
Hmm. The basic one sort of basic bit of information that it seems to be in most, if not all, of the articles and stories that I have read is that... over the last 100 years, there has been an increase in the average global climate of about 1 degree.
Fahrenheit. Yes.
And that apparently there is now just within the last couple of days more information that would support the view that the past few years, that the trend is accelerating, the past few years have been particularly warm. I believe that was it 1996 was the warmest year on record, or just the last year was the warmest year on record?
Well, it depends on which climate data set you're using. There are several. There is one in the UK, which I think is pretty suspect, but they keep announcing this. But, you know, records are not the issue. Trend is the issue, and an accelerating trend definitely has not been observed in any of these records.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think we should have reason to doubt even this basic bit of... information about the approximate one degree increase?
Of course, not the 1 degree increase over the past century. Mm-hmm. That seems to be pretty good. It's usually stated with an error bar. Mm-hmm. You know, it's 0.4 or 0.45 degrees centigrade plus or minus 0.15. And that's over the last century. And if you could go back further, my guess is it would have warmed even more if you went back further because we were coming out of the Little Ice Age.
Hmm.
But that's different from attributing it to man. I mean, if you look at that record, it was doing relatively little between about 1880 and about 1919. Then it goes up about a third of a degree by 1940. It goes down about 0.15 degrees by 1975. It takes a hop in the late 70s up about 0.2, and then it just fluctuates around that value since then. And the fluctuations, of course, mean you keep hitting records because you're already at a high value. But, you know, the usual criterion for being significant is they differ, let's say, from the last maximum in 1940 by more than 0.15 degrees, and they barely do that.
Hmm. What do you think about the proposition that this could be the result of human activity?
Well, I think the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said it, you know, well inside the text, and that is it's so far not possible to distinguish what's happened from natural variability.
How much of an increase do you think we would have to observe before you would think, and not just you personally, but one could say with greater certainty that it was the case?
I mean, statistically, it's a tough problem, but, you know, I would be inclined to say that if we get a full degree centigrade above the 1900 value, that would begin to be out of the range of natural variability, and there would be some case for it. And remember, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 1990 said they expected a third of a degree centigrade per decade.
Mm-hmm.
That would be distinguishable over a couple of decades very clearly from natural variability.
At what point, if indeed we did see such an increase, then at what point do you think that these increases become something that we really need to be concerned about? I mean, how much of an increase is too much?
Well, concern is a personal issue. And my feeling is that clearly the climate has fluctuated a great deal by itself over the past millennium. And that has had significant impacts. I mean, certainly the Little Ice Age had a devastating impact. The medieval optimum when it's warmer was, you know, considered a very good period. Impact should be less these days, I would think, because we're technologically adept and probably have better adaptation tools. The general reckoning is climate change will be less in the tropics than it is at high latitudes, and most of the developing world tends to be low latitude, so they, in fact, should be impacted somewhat less, which, again, means that the societies that are less adaptable also may be less stressed by this. But, you know, I would say that within the range of 1 degree centigrade, hardly anyone regards this as a difficult task. I mean, that would not be a huge damage.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, it may be a benefit for many areas.
Well, how much of an increase would cause damage?
We don't know. We really don't know. I mean, you know, there is a kind of loose argument made that, you know, between the last glacial maximum, you know, cold period and the present, the mean temperature of the Earth only varied 4 degrees. That's a very suspect statement, but what it really comes from is the fact that climate change historically involved very little change in the tropics, but a big change in the temperature difference between the equator and pole. Mm. That suggests almost a totally different mechanism than greenhouse, but be that as it may, it's very different cold than warm. I mean, when we had warm periods, it generally meant an extension of life to other regions and so on. It's very hard to figure out the damage on this, but, you know, I suppose prudence would say that one would try to avoid things like 2 or 3 degrees warming.
Hmm. Well, given that, the question is what, if any steps, we should be taking to reduce the emission of greenhouse gases, with the idea that being that perhaps if we don't start now, by the time we do decide to start, it would be too late. So why not be proactive and make some policy moves now as an investment in the future?
Well, it's a peculiar investment, to be honest. You know, one has to consider what is being proposed, for instance, at Kyoto. And this is, for the developed world, stabilization at anywhere between 1990 and levels and 10% below. By the reckoning of most models I've seen, including those at MIT, this would not matter very much. In other words, if you truly believed a model that said we'd be 4 degrees warmer by 2100, this might knock it down to 3.3. Both would be very warm. Mm-hmm. So we're not really talking about, well, hold it. I should back off that statement. That statement would be true if India and China went along right now. And we're not talking about it. We're talking about the developed world by 2010. That would have a negligible effect on climate. So it'd be mainly a feel-good gesture. It would also, of course, be a convenient way to fulfill all sorts of other agendas, but it really doesn't have much to do with climate. Basically, I think there is an implicit decision in all these things that we're going to adapt. We're going to see what happens, and whatever happens, we'll do like we did in the past. We'll adjust to it.
Hmm.
And to a certain extent, the richer the society is, the better it'll adapt.
Let me reintroduce our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with Richard Lindzen. He is professor of meteorology at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And we're talking this morning about global warming. He is one of the more prominent global warming skeptics, questioning the data, and has said that he feels that at least so far that there is no evidence that global warming is a serious problem. I'm sure he would be quick to say that doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to look at it, but that the data just doesn't support that conclusion so far. We have many opportunities for people to call in with questions, comments, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of questions here from callers, and we'll start with Bloomington, Indiana, and it's line 4. Hello.
Hi, Professor Lindzen. The reason given for the supposed global warming, as I understand it, is an increase in the carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, because carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. So the corrective action that we're supposed to take to reduce to solve the global warming is to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, stop burning petroleum to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. But now a good reliable scientists tell us that one volcano eruption puts more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than all of our human emissions. Yeah, Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines erupted recently, and I understand that it emitted more carbon dioxide than mankind has ever emitted or could emit in centuries. So I guess the question is, if any reduction that we humans would make in carbon dioxide would be a mere pittance beside the volcanic emissions, and since it would cause considerable human inconvenience, if not suffering, what's the percentage?
Well, you've asked several questions. Actually, volcanoes are not major sources of carbon dioxide compared to man. But the more significant point is, although carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, it's a relatively minor one. I mean, the main greenhouse gas in the atmosphere is water vapor. Crudely speaking, doubling carbon dioxide is about equivalent to increasing the upper level, you know, above 2-3 kilometers. Water vapor, the relative humidity, let's say, by about 5-6%. We don't even measure it that much, that accuracy. So under the circumstances, we really can't say what the net greenhouse gas is. But carbon dioxide alone, for instance, doubling carbon dioxide, if you kept everything constant, just let the temperature change in the gross, that would increase warming, you know, temperature about a third of a degree. You know, one of the things one has to keep straight is the peculiarity of the English language. We use the word warming to mean temperature is increased, and we also use it in the active sense of causing a temperature increase. The temperature has increased, and I don't think the world is any the worse for it over the last century, but the argument is about whether man has contributed much to it.
Yes.
It doesn't matter that we've contributed a little. I mean, if you could establish that of the 1 degree Fahrenheit over the last century, a tenth of that was due to man, you would have proven that global warming is not a problem.
Yes, indeed, and I understand that all of the emphasis, at least most of the emphasis in global warming, has been put on carbon dioxide and all of the emission reduction emphasis has been in reducing the emissions of carbon dioxide, but you say apparently that carbon dioxide is only a minor player. So aren't we apparently we're emphasizing the wrong thing?
Well, we don't have any control over water vapor or clouds.
Right.
Whether we have control over carbon dioxide is an open question. I mean, it is true that the geochemical system is such that, for instance, reducing or curbing emissions does not terribly change the fact that we're going to still change the amount of CO2.
Well, now, about these volcanoes, I've heard several reports. I obviously don't have any personal knowledge.
No, what the volcanoes do is spew out stuff which turns into sulfate and layers which reflect light. And their effect on the radiation for a couple of years is much bigger than that of the CO2.
Yeah, and that's a cooling. That's a cooling.
Yes, right, right.
Yeah.
But, you know, the argument usually is that these are transient events.
Yes.
And so in the long run, CO2 will win. But that depends on what you expect CO2 to do. As I say, just increasing CO2 does very little. What happens is we're using computer models that actually amplify what CO2 alone would do. They amplify it a great deal. And the question is, should we believe that? And my feeling is we should not believe that because the amplification is due to processes that can be individually tested. And in crucial regards, they keep failing. So, you know, we have a case where models using physics that seems to be wrong are predicting something beyond what carbon dioxide alone would do, and we're acting on the basis of that, which seems to me imprudent.
Well, you're very reassuring. David, thanks for the time.
Sure thing. We have some other callers here. Let me just reintroduce our guest real quick, and then we'll go on to the next one. Our guest this morning, Richard Lindzen. He's professor of meteorology at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We're talking about global warming. We've certainly done a number of programs on this topic, generally speaking with guests who believe that global warming is a problem, that it is a result of human activity, and that it's something that we ought to be addressing.
You know, David, if I may interrupt.
Yes, sir.
I don't know who your other guests were, but, you know, in saying that the warming of the last century was due primarily to man, whoever said that went well beyond anything said by the IPCC.
That's the UN appointed body of scientists that you
referred to. Of which I'm a member.
Well, I think, for example, one of the people that we've talked to within the past few months on the topic is Richard Somerville, who's director of the Climate Research Division at Scripps Institute of Oceanography at UC San Diego.
And he said the change over the last century was primarily due to man?
I believe that he said that.
I really doubt that.
Well, I would have to, of course, consult my notes and go back and listen
but
to the program.
I'll be glad to tell him he said that.
Well, you know, well, if I am misquoting him, then it's certainly
I mean, there's a funny thing going on. And, you know, scientists often speak a different language than the population at large.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, that UN remark that there is a discernible influence from man. While questionable, nevertheless would be regarded as scientists as saying almost nothing. And yet the body politic took this to be a very strong statement. So if, you know, there's a tendency in translation, I think, to get things a little bit confused.
Well, let me ask you a question, because on a recent program, I was sort of taken to task by a listener who wrote me a letter who said that I was misinforming the listeners when I say that there is consensus in the scientific community on the issue. Now, I would not intentionally mislead anyone.
That's the impression
that I get from reading on the subject, that while not all scientists agree, that a majority, at least over half, agree.
Okay.
Is that not the case?
It depends on how it's used, the statement. I mean, this is a very funny issue. I mean, although it's been around a long time, I think it's fair to say that it appeared on the political radar screen strongly in 1988. And when it appeared, there was an immediate statement from environmental groups and from politicians supportive of the issue that all scientists agreed. It took about 10 years almost to make it clear that this wasn't true. But I think whenever you hear a statement, all scientists agree, it's usually not scientists who are saying it. It's usually a propaganda statement designed to choke off any questions from people who don't understand the issue. It says, you know, who am I to question? And this would be true for CEOs in industry as well. Mm-hmm. If they hear all scientists agree, they tend to back off. But it is very rare for all scientists or even most scientists to agree, and it's very rare to even take votes. And so, for instance, the IPCC is usually cited as saying 2,500 scientists all agree. But, you know, all the skeptics you know of were probably participants in the IPCC, and they don't agree.
Hmm.
My experience was you were asked about the paragraph you commented on or contributed to, and nobody asked you if you agreed with anything else.
Hmm.
So I think one is using that as a kind of hatchet to beat down opposition, but any time you go to a scientific meeting of the American Meteorological Society, the American Geophysical Union, you see there's a great deal of questioning and uncertainty and skepticism. And of course, if you go on to the other things like, you know, storms and so on, there have never even been any assertions on that. And yet the people who say all scientists agree usually add on all those things as well.
You know, I'm consulting my notes from my conversation with Professor Somerville, and I happen to think maybe you're correct and that I'm misrepresenting him. I don't believe that he did say that we know that that the increase in carbon dioxide, the increase in average global temperature, is a result of human activity. I don't think that he said that. So I should.
Yeah,
there I go again, misleading
people. It's perfectly
people.
Understandable. I just, one of the frustrations in this issue is this, you know, two languages business.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if somebody, you know, says, look, I'm mainstream, you tend to assume that they agree. But I think one has to be very careful of that. I think people are speaking in different terms of reference. And very often, when you think they're saying one thing, they may be saying something else. I mean, unfortunately.
Well, we have some other callers to bring into our conversation, so let us do that. We will continue talking with our guest, Richard Lindzen from MIT. The lines are full right at the moment, but as soon as we free up some lines as we talk with callers, if you would like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Piatt County on line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'm very interested in your program, and I do congratulate you, David, and WILL for having somebody on that has some questions regarding what everybody seems to take for granted. We're talking about the emissions of CO2. Does that, if I understand things correctly, plants breathe CO2. Wouldn't that in turn make the earth greener, therefore maybe a little cooler, and then the plants emit more oxygen, make it a better air to have?
Well, you know, this is something where there is remarkable agreement. I mean, there is no question for most plant species, increased CO2 will lead to greater growth. Yes, plants do use CO2 for photosynthesis. They need it. If you had too little CO2, as during the last ice age, below 200 parts per million as opposed to the present 355 or the pre-industrial 280, a lot of species were unable to survive in lots of areas that today thrive. So that part is probably a plus. It also tends to make plants, according to most experiments, more resilient to decreased water, to drought, and to cold. So, in general, for agriculture, what do they call controlled ecosystems, it's a plus. People have argued whether for other ecosystems it would work as well. I'm no expert on that.
I have another question. This will be my final question. President Clinton is a NAFTA. He wants free trade, so to speak, with the nations, and particularly with China. And then when I understand that Global Treaty Convention, or whatever it's called, is coming up in Kyoto, Japan next week, they want to give special considerations to Mexico and China and Indonesia and maybe some other
lots of countries.
All right.
Yeah.
Isn't this a hypocrisy?
Well, you know, that's a political call. It certainly makes... I have to say that this government has been opposed to applying any agreement non-uniformly, as far as I know. So we are asking China and India and so on to offer some assurances on this. I think they would be probably wise to avoid it.
Well, this consideration that it is...
But you're right, with NAFTA... It has an obvious effect.
In principle,
our industry could just move to the countries that don't have curbs.
For those that support that, is this an agenda for worldwide socialism?
You know, one of the tricky things with this issue is carbon dioxide is so basic to our existence. It's a product of all our burning of fossil fuels. It's a product of breathing. A product of many agricultural practices, that there is a temptation to use it for lots of agendas. I mean, I'm sure there's some people who see this as a convenient way for wealth transfer from the developing to the developed world. I can imagine a lot of people see this as a convenient way to increase taxes without opposition. It can be a convenient way for the EPA to see itself growing to being a dominant agency. You know, there are a lot of people who can benefit in the short run from exploiting this issue. I mean, you know, some of it could be perfectly good, energy efficiency, renewable energy sources. But in a sense, none of these agendas have much to do with warming. They're just exploiting it.
Thank you very much, David.
All right, thank you. On to another caller. This is Urbana, and it's line two. Hello.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
The stuffy organization that I belong to, called the American Waterworks Association, published an article in their journal just this month in which they sign on to the idea of global warming and encourage managers of drinking water treatment systems to take it into consideration. Also urge government at all levels to really reevaluate their approaches to managing water resources in light of possible climate change.
Well, how would you do that?
Implementation is not there, but they I think it's just putting it on the agenda, just putting it in the agenda.
Well,
and
I'm
puzzled. Consider that it's going to be a factor.
Yeah, but are they saying that they expect drought or floods or what?
Nope, not much more beyond that. Say the author of this, principal author, is a fellow named Peter Gleick. Do you know of him?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, what I've seen is, you know, as the administration has tried to drum up public support, that makes it a political issue, and all sorts of groups, including, I found, the cover group for all Jewish community fundraising group, Third and Forbes, in which they interviewed a scientist at Harvard, Peter Rogers. And he made the perfectly good point that the IPCC document doesn't say any of these things if you read the text. What happens is it has a policymaker's summary that picks and chooses and makes it sound serious, and nobody bothers to read the 600 pages of text, which make it seem as though we don't know.
Well, speaking of politics, author Ross Gelbspan says you're pretty political yourself.
Yeah, he says I'm the most ideological person he's ever met. Now, this is a man who's written books about the U.S. killing people who oppose Central American policy and killing them in America, and so on. I mean, I don't know how you judge that. There was a 1994 show, Nightline, with Ted Koppel, and he announced that Vice President Gore had asked him to try and dig up dirt on anyone who opposed Gore on climate change. And I knew, even though Koppel responded honorably, somebody would salute. And apparently it was Gelbspan, so he tries to say there are only three or four people who oppose.
That was his book, yes.
Yeah, and that we're all stooges of industry. And for me, he realized none of my research is supported by industry, so he claims I was ideological. I don't know. I mean, I guess that means that I'm not a liberal Democrat or something.
Do you support continuing research into the climate of our planet?
Look, I have a vested interest. I'm a research scientist.
Okay.
Of course I do.
Okay.
I think, you know, one of the problems with this issue is, you know, if there's any area of agreement with my colleagues, you know, it is this is a serious issue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm suspicious of that, to be honest. I mean, I know of no scientist who will say that his field doesn't represent a serious issue.
Yeah.
But that's not the same thing. It shouldn't be the same thing as encouraging what could be draconian political action.
Well, he also reported that due to the work of Congressman Dana Rohrabacher of California, funding for research was cut.
You know, strangely enough, it's very hard to tell. I don't think that's true, but there have been areas where research has been cut, and it hasn't been due to Rohrabacher. There has been a general budget constraint. Now, most of the money spent on climate research is for NASA's satellite program, and there's been a lot of controversy as to whether that's even an effective way of spending. So if you look at the gross budgets, that can be confusing. We've been spending a lot. I mean, including NASA, it's been on the order of $2 billion a year on research. In some ways, it's surprising how little has actually come out of that.
I hope the caller will forgive me for jumping in, because we only have, at this point, about 12 or 13 minutes, and we have some other callers, and I want to try to include as many different people as possible. So with his indulgence, I will go on. We'll talk to a caller in Carmi. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hi. I want to appeal to common sense here for just a minute. When you look at photographs of the Earth from out in space, and you see this small blue and white ball, and you realize that just a small percentage of that diameter it is the core of the Earth. And we continue to pull minerals and drill for minerals out of that core and dump them into this thin layer of atmosphere. And I have to ask, can't we expect at some time or another to see some change from that activity?
Well, that's something that, you know, it depends quantitatively on what you mean. If you mean change at any level whatever, I suppose the answer is we undoubtedly will. If you mean a change that's likely to be very detrimental, I don't think any case has been made for it. I don't think it's a matter of common sense.
So you're open to the fact that change doesn't matter. It's only whether the change is positive or not.
Well, I think that's one thing for sure, that, you know, at some level, the Earth is always changing whether we're here or not. A notion of a static world is not a natural world.
If we were to take some preventative measures in regards to CO2, would we not be erring on the side of safety here? Would that not be something good in your opinion?
It depends. You know, in other words, as I pointed out, the things suggested so far will have almost no impact on climate. And so, to quote Bill Nordhaus at Yale, an economist, we're hitting on trillion-dollar solutions to billion-dollar problems. That makes no sense. You wouldn't do it personally.
And have you thought, have you ever thought personally of what it would take, or the scale of what would happen to change?
Could you
elaborate on that just?
Sure. I mean, it's been widely reported that if you wanted to stabilize carbon dioxide as opposed to emissions, you'd probably have to cut emissions about 60-70%. And that would essentially bring our country to a standstill and condemn the developing world to permanent poverty. That seems a pretty extreme gesture for an uncertain science.
All right.
Thanks for the call. Well, I suppose some people would say that if you tried to do that overnight, it would bring our country to a standstill. But that if you would do it over a period of time, that the gains that you would get if you would develop renewable energy sources, new energy efficient technologies, that in some people would be prepared to argue that you would actually be ahead at
well,
at,
you know,
once
how
you
shall
do
I
that.
Put it, the total system is so complex that I wouldn't even try and argue against it. We don't know. I mean, you know, it could be that 50 years from now, all electricity will be nuclear and that all cars will run off fuel cells that are energized by the nuclear power and our emissions will fall precipitously. And it may, in fact, have nothing to do with any government regulation. Indeed, there are other people would argue that if you try and regulate the means by which we approach something, you make it harder to achieve in the long run. I mean, it's not at all inconceivable that the proposed measures in the long run could be very bad for the environment. It's not as though it's simple to know what's good.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another caller in Champaign, line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. I like to know something that I cannot ask the Almighty because I cannot find him, but you may be able to give me an answer even if it is a no answer. It is known that the Earth is losing vapor, water vapor, to the universe, and it is also known that it is constantly being replenished by ice comets that melt in the atmosphere. That effect by itself would keep the temperature or excess temperature low.
I'm not sure how.
I don't know what the rate is, if it can be measured, what the rate is of the water.
This is dragging in other controversies as to whether the ice balls entering the atmosphere are a significant source of water vapor. It's pretty sure they dissociate before.
But I still believe it has to be some truth in it, because if you look at Mars, no ice balls there, and there is no water either. Maybe a little bit remnant stuff from so many billion years ago.
True enough.
I mean, you know, I'm just saying you're entering in a whole other area of controversy.
I was just interested in it to see.
I think it's an interesting topic. I don't think it's a large impact on the net radiative budget.
You don't.
And the water vapor budget itself comes from a fairly complex process of recycling air. You know, air goes up in clouds, the water condenses.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it rains out. Some of it's available to moisturize the atmosphere.
Yeah.
That's a crucial process in the radiative budget. And that's one of the processes that's totally misrepresented in models.
Mm, I see. Thank you for your answer.
Right, okay. Thank you. We'll go on to another caller over in Indiana, Munster, Indiana, line number two. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was calling because I just had a question that is, do you think that the burning of fossil fuels has any detrimental effect on the environment?
Because, oh, sure.
I mean, just the fact that when I live in probably the armpit of the whole nation, you know.
Gary.
Yeah, seeing all this stuff going into the air, I just think this has to have some effect.
Oh, let's straighten out certain things. When you breathe, you exhale carbon dioxide. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're not causing a hell of a lot of pollution, to the best of my knowledge. Now, smokestacks emit a lot of stuff, not just carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a relatively innocent thing. But, you know, they introduce soot and sulfur and so on, and NOx, oxides of nitrogen, oxides of sulfur. And these can have detrimental effects. We pretty much know how to reduce those and have profoundly over the years. So the question then is, should we get rid of anything we emit, even if it's not bad, because there were some things that were emitted in burning fossil fuels that were normal pollutants and which we can control reasonably economically. If it weren't economical to control the other things to meet air quality standards, then people would have switched from fossil fuels.
But if the rate of consumption in other countries was as great as it is in our country, do you think that there would be a much larger problem?
Well, most of the pollutants you're speaking about tend to fall out of the atmosphere in about 3 days, so they wouldn't travel very far from these countries. They would constitute a problem for the countries emitting. And like us, I mean, you know, I don't know how old you are, but in the 40s, Pittsburgh was awful. And, you know, as prosperity returned after the war, it became a priority of people to make Pittsburgh more livable. And I think you'll find this every place. And when that happens, people put on scrubbers and change the fuels. There are fuels that are better and worse. And in general, want to live in a cleaner environment. A clean environment becomes a priority as you can afford it. If you're looking for your bread and your subsistence, it becomes less of a priority.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, we'll go again to another caller. This is Sumner. It's line number three. Hello.
Yes, I just had a couple of comments and a question, and then I'll hang up. You know, one comment, I think it's probably human nature for us to want to kind of preserve the status quo, and I think that's one reason maybe that people don't want to, you know, look at something that kind of alarms them. You know, we want to keep all of our conveniences and
yes.
have any sacrifices.
Again, it's an age issue, but how many people do you know when they retire in Illinois or Indiana move to the Sun Belt, and how many do you know who move to the Northwest Territory of Canada?
Most would probably move south.
Yeah, so it's saying your personal preference is if you have to have anything, you'd like it a bit warmer.
Well, but maybe you didn't understand what I was saying. I was saying that we would rather not think that we would have to sacrifice anything for, you know, the common good. And one thing I'm thinking about are all the cars that we drive everywhere, which is, you know, of course, our source of carbon dioxide. You know, another thing I don't know if you've mentioned or not is this, you know, phenomenal growth in human population. And, you know, even though maybe up to this point we're saying, well, you know, maybe human causes have not increased the CO2 in the atmosphere, you know, how can we, you know, how can we project that into the future with any...
Oh, look, I sympathize with your concerns. I think all of them would be things that people could argue.
And aren't they things we should be doing anyway, no matter if...
Well, you know, if you're concerned with population, how do you see controlling carbon emissions fitting into it?
Well, you know, for instance, China now, they're putting in a new power plant every 2 weeks, and they don't have the technology.
Yeah, what do you propose to do about that? Go to
war
with China?
I think there are some things individuals can do.
No. Would you bomb China?
No.
Would you tell them you want them to stay poor?
No, I think...
Would you prohibit them from reproducing?
Well,
they are already doing that very much themselves.
Yeah, they have. They have.
What's your point?
You know, well, my point is that I think we need to look at global warming as a possible problem.
Sure.
And, you know, that these are things that we probably should be addressing anyway.
All I'm saying is we shouldn't confuse it with concerns of a population. We shouldn't confuse it with all sorts of concerns for other pollution.
Because
that'll just confuse our ability to study the issue.
But you don't think they're connected?
If they're connected, we better understand the connection rather than assume it.
Well,
because that may make us inefficient in solving the real problem. If you're concerned about sulfate emission, you work on sulfate emission. If you're concerned with population, you study that. But you don't take this abstract view of saying, I'm going to curb carbon dioxide emissions and assume that'll contribute to all the things I'd really like to solve.
But don't you think that curbing carbon dioxide emissions would be doing some things that we probably should be doing anyway to
like what?
Fossil fuels, to, you know, reduce...
Let's put it this way. If you're concerned with automobile emissions, and we have been, we've designed cars that emit much less. Doesn't that make more sense?
It does, except we're just driving so many more of them.
Well, but, you know, we're emitting less.
I think I'm going to jump in at this point, and because we're at the end of the time, and say we will have to leave it at that. My appreciation to all the callers, and to you, Professor Lindzen. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Our guest, Richard Lindzen, he's professor of meteorology at Massachusetts Institute of Technology.